We're continuing going through the triads to review. We began with three fundamental aspects of mindfulness practice: knowing, sensing, relaxing, which when done brings about stability, well-being, and confidence, which sets the foundation for a significant insight into the changing nature of our experience, its inconstancy, into dukkha, suffering, and into not-self. Those insights are consequential if our minds have been operating under ideas of permanence, ideas, chasing after ideas of happiness that are not reliable, and holding on to ideas of self which are fragile. That hurt. And that shift from holding on to permanence of any kind, holding on to happinesses of any kind, holding on to self of any kind, giving that up or seeing that it's not working anymore, can lead to a disillusionment, a disinterest, which in the Dharma practice points to a disillusionment with clinging and craving, attachments of all kinds. And it leads to the fading away of the drive, the compulsion. And today is the last of this current triad, which is cessation. Nibbida, viraga, nirodha, disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation. Cessation is an ending. The word nirodha is usually translated as cessation. I think it's very meaningful to look at the etymology of this word. The ni is a prefix for kind of no or not. And the roda means obstacle. And so kind of literally in an etymological way, it means the ending of obstacles. No obstacle. And that maybe has a different association for us and even emotional feeling, to think of it as the end of obstructions, then it's just plain and simple cessation, which can seem kind of cold, perhaps, or like, what does that leave us with? So endings are very important in Dharma practice. The ending of being lost is a relief. And some people, when they discover this practice or the Dharma, feel like they're no longer lost. What a relief. The ending of misunderstanding can feel enlightening. And this practice can come with the ending of misunderstanding of all kinds. The ending of inner war is peace. The ending of suffering is liberation. So a very important part of this path of the Dharma, the path of liberation, is to appreciate endings. To appreciate the end of obstructions, barriers, blocks that we might live with, live under. So at the heart of it, it's the ending of craving, ending of clinging, attachment. And we can value this when we see for ourselves how obstructing clinging is, how obstructing craving and attachments can be. Sometimes we have attachments and cravings, that addictions, compulsions that we've spent a lifetime specializing in. Some of you are very sophisticated people, very intelligent people. I would say, you know, I should congratulate all of you on being really sophisticated and intelligent. And the downside of that is that all that can be used just to cling in a sophisticated way, to cling with amazing intelligence. Some of the intelligence can go to justifying why it's necessary to cling and hold on. Which sometimes it might be necessary if the alternative is worse. But one of the places we can see where clinging can be an obstruction, the limiting factor for our lives, is especially in meditation. Start seeing more clearly the details of what goes on moment to moment in the mind and in the heart. And we see the consequence. We see the limitations that patterns of thinking and patterns of way of being. And it's, partly, you know, again, with so many things we don't advertise, and we advertise this practice publicly. But, you know, a lot of what we see in this practice is bad news. You know, we see how we cling, we see what doesn't work. And if you believe the advertisements, then it seems like something is wrong. But I hope that whatever advertisement you saw, there was a disclaimer, you know, down the bottom in small print. this endeavor may be, might challenge your attachments. They might put tremendous risk for your clingings. But we take no liability. We start seeing this stuff, and that's part of what we're dredging up and learning to see, so we can become mature and honest and complete and find a way through it and beyond it. And the analogy that's used sometimes for a certain kind of mind is monkey mind. And many of you, probably all of you, heard this. And as I understand this analogy, it's the monkeys are swinging from tree to tree, from branch to branch. And if they're really just in the process of swinging fast, by the time that they have let go of one branch, or by the time they're immediately grabbing the next one, and the next one, then there's no pause in the grabbing. And so the mind can be that way sometimes, where we just go on to the next thought, the next thought. And it's remarkable, you know, I've sat and meditated and been troubled by something that won't leave me alone. And then, lo and behold, maybe accidentally it stopped. You think after days, months of being troubled by something, it'd be nice to just kind of enjoy the absence. But there's a, you know, it's almost like the mind has a to-do list. You know, you can't do nothing. So you grab for something else, the next thing and the next thing. Always occupying the mind with thoughts. And I think that's reasonable if we're living in our thinking. If that's all we know, kind of, about how to find our way in life and figure things out or do something. Thoughts are always about something. The aboutness of thoughts are the branches. We're thinking about this and that lunch. We had lunch, then we think about dinner. Once we have dinner, we think about evening tea. Had evening tea, we think about, should I have a snack before going to bed, or should I wait for breakfast? Have a snack before going to bed, and then think, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Whatever, it's always about something. And so some people live in the world of aboutness. And they're always, you know, they're chasing aboutness and thinking about it, and the past, the future, what happened, what will happen. And in order to be in that world of aboutness, it has to be generated with thoughts and images, ideas. So I imagine that the monkey is swinging through the trees. If they just decide to not grab the next branch, and they're in midair, no, it's enough grabbing. It's a long way down to fall. What happens to us if we don't grab the next branch, the next aboutness to think about and do? It can, for some people, it can feel like you're going to crash, you're going to fall. Do we fall? Have you ever tried? It's possible, yes. You'll be left in midair. Arms, one stretched out to the back, one to the front. And lo and behold, you fly. The end of clinging. The end of clinging for a bird is it soars. The branch at some point becomes a, or the clinging to the branch is the obstacle for the bird, an obstacle for the bird to do its birdness. In what degree is your clinging an obstacle for your suchness, your thusness, for who you are in some deeper way than you can ever think and imagine and know consciously? Maybe you'll fly. So one of the things that we can do in this practice is begin pausing or appreciating the endings, the cessations that do occur. Not be in a hurry to go on to the next thing, but notice what it's like. You've been maybe, you know, challenged by the hindrances. And then you come back to a sitting and the hindrance is gone. It's over. Where did it go? Well, it's great to have no longer have the hindrance because now you can think about the next meal. Or some other exciting topic. Or you can pause and take in the what it's like to have it come to an end. What's this like? What's the absence of a hindrance like now that it's not there? What's the absence of fear like, anxiety, if it's stopped, even if it's temporary? The absence of restlessness. The absence of doubt. Of anger. And there's different ways that these kind of things can end, can stop, can cease. They can do it kind of casually. They kind of like go do a walking meditation and come back and it's gone. What happened? And it can go away kind of visibly, you can see it go. Wow. The release, the relief. And it's possible sometimes where that visibly seen ending has a qualitative quality to it that gets our attention. Wow. That ended. Many years ago, a woman came back to a retreat a year after being on one and said, wow, I've always been cynical, as far as I can remember. And after that retreat a year ago, it stopped. I saw it stop suddenly. It was like fresh air or open space. I didn't know this was possible. And now it's been a year and hasn't come back. Wow. And there's many things like this that can come to an end. Most commonly, they come to an end when there's been a fading away, a gradual process of thinning. And that thinning and fading away, I think of it as really being a fading away and thinning of our fueling it, our engagement with it, our caught upness in it, our resistance to it, or running away from it, or all these different ways attacking it. All these ways, all these efforts are paradoxically, even when we try to get rid of it, it can make it get stronger. So to have a fading away of being so influenced by it, so caught by it, so preoccupied, so upset or something, the fading of that interest, the disinteresting, one of the most remarkable forms of disenchantment that the Buddha talked about. It kind of took me by surprise when I saw it in the text. He talked about becoming disenchanted with suffering. What? Am I not already disenchanted? To be interested in suffering, to be somehow, you know, and one way to be fascinated with it is to think that it's a problem, it's a mistake, that it reflects back on you personally and who you are, to define who you are, and all kinds of ways. We're intensely interested sometimes. Sometimes we're more interested in what's difficult than what is wonderful. So the fading away of this misplaced interest, reactivity, and as it fades away enough, Sometimes something doesn't just fade away and stop, maybe temporarily, but there can be a feeling that something has been released. Something has opened. Something has been freed. And what can make a big impression on the heart is not that that particular issue stopped being there to trouble us, but rather by what's been set free, the flying, the soaring, the remarkable feeling of a pure heart or a unshakable heart, or a heart that's at home in itself, a heart which is clear, bright, unobstructed. So this fading away, that's such an important process, has a lot to do with leaving ourselves alone. Leaving things alone. The nature of all activities in the mind is to calm down. is to slow down, is to calm down. And what prevents it is our reactivity and our involvement and our being caught in it and feeding it. And that's why it's such a powerful thing to get out of the way and not contribute to the fuel anymore. So that seemingly natural process of settling, of relaxing, of unwinding, of burning up the fuels so the fire gets quieter and smaller and can cool and stop. So leaving ourselves alone. And part of the function of knowing and sensing, being aware, is to discover how to do that. Such a open, permissive, accepting, peaceful way that it really supports, really enables this leaving ourselves alone. And it's not an easy thing to find, because the knowing, the sensing can be interpreted to be, okay, gotta get to work here. I'm supposed to be chugging away like the little train that could. And it's like that sometimes, but what we're building towards, what we're working towards, and is to have the inner strength, skill, and capacity for knowing to be so simple that it's a getting out of the way of what we know. We're leaving it alone to just be known without being for or against it. Where we are sensing, and the sensing is not the reacting, pushing, probing, just sensing. So in the sense, just the sensed, and the seen, just the seen, means we leave everything alone as they are. But in the knowing, in the awaring, in the awareness, just aware. And to have that awareness, that knowing, be certainly getting out of the way of the experience, but to really kind of, it's kind of like let it really create the space, the clarity, the brightness, so things are really known. Really, the more they're really known, the more they're really allowed to be themselves. And if they're really allowed to be themselves, they'll move towards peace. If we're not fueling it. So, in this teachings of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, he talks about knowing, sensing. The third kind of attention, a form of attention that he refers to, is seeing. I've talked about these already, but the fourth one he talks about has the word sati or mindfulness in it, but it has a prefix. That is called a reflexive prefix, meaning it reflects back on itself. So it's a reflect, and it's a, and if we translate sati as awareness, it is reflexive awareness. Pati sati is the word. It's a word of pati sati. I like saying it. And And so this idea that the awareness is strong enough that we know we're aware. Most people are aware all their waking hours, but they don't really know they're aware. They're grabbing branches. But we're no longer, you know, focusing on the branches and grabbing on them. Then there's space for the knowing, the sensing to kind of heighten, strengthen the capacity for awareness. When we're not preoccupied and distracted, then what's left is this growing sense of being present, here, aware. Until the sense of awareness is strong enough that it can be seen and recognized. Wow. Patisati. I like to translate it into the whole thing into English as lucid awareness. Lucid awareness. Which is Bhikkhu Bodhi's preferred translation for the word sati without the prefix. This great scholar who's responsible for so much of how we understand the Dharma. His preferred way of translating sati is not mindfulness, but lucid awareness. But I reserve that for patisati. And so at some point awareness becomes its own thing. It's valued and appreciated, and it's not obscured by our preoccupations and concerns. And the value of that, it's kind of like then there's really a lot of room for all the mental machinations of the mind to settle, to relax, to unwind. There's breathing room, lots of breathing room. There's a verse in the ancient teachings that is called the maxim of the arhats, the saying of those who are fully awakened. It's kind of like their anthem that they, you know, would sing in celebration maybe of their awakening. And most of you know it. Anicca vata sankara upadavaya dhammino upagito va niruccanti tesam vipassamo sukho. All mental activities are inconstant. They have the nature to arise and pass. Seeing their passing is the greatest happiness. So to really understand the mind, the mental activities of the mind, and to make room for them to settle, to still, the stilling of these mental formations is the greatest happiness. It's not talking about oblivion. It's not talking about, you know, somehow just checking out. It's not talking about some big bang experience of enlightenment, whatever that is. But it's a distilling of all the mental formations They're passing, they're stilling. Here the Buddha says, and what is the perception of cessation? So in some ways we can see, we can have some perception of things cease and the cessation occurs. Or we might translate it, and what is the perception of non-obstruction? Here, having gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, a practitioner reflects thus, this is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling of all mental activities, the relinquishment of all attachments, the destruction of craving, cessation, nibbana. This is called the perception of cessation. So peaceful. This is moving towards cessation, to perceive cessation, non-obstruction, is to perceive that this is peaceful. Quite something. So rather than cessation being kind of like this oblivion or everything ends, so this, when we realize this is the real peace, this is the stilling of all mental activities, the relinquishment of all attachments, the destruction of craving. It's very particular. It's a specific. It's very, can we say, I don't know if I want to say this word. Maybe you'll forgive me. You'll restate it in a better way. It's very concrete. It's very definitive. This is not some like vague idea of what enlightenment might be and cosmic union with the bird crows and what is that about? That's nice. You can write beautiful haiku and the oneness. Birds. And for centuries, people will be in awe and wonder, and how do they manage that? Oh, cessation is happening. Had different ways. For those of you who don't see that, someone just closed the windows. So anyway, I'm trying to say that this, what I read here is how specific it is. It's very clear. It's a guideline. It's support. It's a directionality. It's, oh, I see. This is what it's about. So the stilling, the bringing to peace, the agitations of the mind. Somewhere else, that's how the Buddha refers to it. Yes, I think I have it here. Yeah. Oh, I'll read this one. When practitioners have heard that nothing is worth clinging to, They directly know everything. If you want to be omniscient, this is the way. When practitioners have heard that nothing is worth clinging to, they directly know everything. Having directly known everything, they fully understand everything. Having fully understood everything, what they mean is fully understand something about everything. Not everything about everything, but some, the crucial thing. Having fully understood everything, whatever feeling they feel, whether pleasant or painful, and neither painful nor pleasant, they abide observing inconstancy in those feelings, observing fading away, observing cessation, observing relinquishment. Observing in this way, they do not cling to anything in the world. When they do not cling, they are not agitated. When they are not agitated, they attain Nibbana. So again, it suggests that it's very specific and clear what this is about. To see the changing and constant nature of our experience in such a way that you're not straining, such a way that you're not fueling more agitation, more spinning, more, but the opposite. You're seeing and knowing in such a way that it allows for something to quiet, allows something to unwind, settle. And so there can be a fading away. And then there can be a cessation, sometimes temporary, sometimes in an impactful way. Wow. This shows me a potential that I didn't know I had, but this is really important. So what I'd like to suggest for you is that you become curious, interested, very interested in the tremendous value of being disinterested. Be interested in disinterest until that's the last interest. Just be interested in what it's like to see and know in a way that might kind of leave things alone, including leaving yourself alone, just making space, breathing room for what is, but to do it in such a way that there's a little bit of a, you know, a real showing up, a real being present, taking a stand here at this time, here and now, because it's the fullness of awareness, the fullness of that presence that gives enough room for the stilling of the mind, stilling the mental activities. And then see what happens. See, notice when things come to an end. And to do that, as I've said earlier in the retreat, you have to kind of start living in the time it takes for a moment to unfold. Sometimes they're short moments, sometimes a moment is extended. But to see the ending of something, there is there an extended moment. Maybe you see the ending of knowing. Maybe you see the ending of what you knew. Maybe you didn't, weren't, maybe the ending was a surprise. If you are on the eighth precept, since you're not eating supper, but you go through the dining room when supper is being served, and you look down at the serving table, and you're like, wow, that's my favorite dish. But I put my name on the board, eight precepts. So they're not expecting me to have food. I'm not hungry. So all this goes on. But then you keep going and you go outside and you're still thinking about the food. Now you're thinking about something which is not in eyesight. And thinking about something which is not present is very different than thinking about something which is present. Because now you're clearly in the world of ideas, thoughts, constructions, fantasy. The real supper has ceased to be in direct eyesight. But the fantasy supper continues in your mind. What would it take to know that so well, so fully, that it comes to an end? Kind of you're there to be the midwife of its ending, or the midwife of the that which comes when there's no longer any obstruction. What is it? What is it there? What is this? What happens with the endings? What happens with non-obstruction? What is left to appreciate, to value? Might it be that instead of falling, you, in some way, you fly. So in these few moments I sat here when the talk was over, I was very aware the talk is done, it's ended. But then I could feel that the momentum of giving a talk was still in my body. So a certain energy, certain, doesn't feel exactly agitation exactly, but that's what it is. But I had a nice flowing feeling. A little bit more energy going up into my brain than I normally would like to have. So I just allowed it to be there. And as I allowed it to be there, I could feel in those few seconds, I could feel it kind of dissipate. I could feel the stilling. And then it occurs to me that we should really end this. Thank you all.